From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the first of a series of specials on Asia. Asia is widely recognized as the new and still rising center of economic power in the world. According to the CIA World Factbook, four of the world's top largest economies are based in Asia: China, the world's largest economy; India, which is third behind the United States; Japan at number four; and Indonesia at number nine. The Russian Federation, at number six, is both in Europe and Asia. But those facts don't tell the whole story, which is that Asian economies are still growing at a much faster rate than those of the U.S. and EU. For example, 30 years ago, according to the IMF, the U.S. was number one, the USSR number two, Japan was number three, and China and India were numbers 9 and 10, respectively. Asia has become the battleground for an emerging bloc geopolitics between the U.S. and EU on one side, and groupings like the BRICS, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and the Eurasian Economic Union on the other. The legacy of Western colonialism in Asia is a series of national, political, and economic contradictions that perhaps is best represented on the Korean Peninsula. Americans know less about Korea, particularly North Korea, officially the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, than any other nation on Earth. Regularly demonized in the West, there is more to the DPRK than meets the eye. On that, we spoke with Brian Becker of the Answer Coalition, which is organizing visits by delegations of Americans to the DPRK beginning this October. Brian, welcome back. A pleasure to have you as always.
Thank you.
So I think we're starting this series on Asia, and I wanted to focus in the beginning at Korea, because many of the contradictions that exist in Asia between Asian countries and their allies and the Western bloc, the former colonialists, are really well represented there. And there are even now some contradictions in play, like South Korea's emerging relationship with China and such, that I want to get into, but people lack the basic historical understanding of Korea. So maybe we could start there.
Certainly. As we all know right now, Korea is and remains a divided peninsula, even though Korea has a 5,000-year-old sort of unitary cultural, geographic, linguistic tradition. For the past 70 years, it's been a divided country, and it was divided along the 38th parallel at the Potsdam Conference, where the Soviet Union, Britain, and the United States, the victors in World War II, were reconfiguring a post-world order. And U.S. officials who didn't speak Korean, didn't know anything about it, took a pen and literally drew a line down the Korean Peninsula in the middle of it at the 38th parallel and said, here's where the dividing line will be, and South Korea will be under U.S. jurisdiction and North Korea will be under Soviet jurisdiction. And there was also an agreement that in 1948, within 3 years, that both sides would leave the Korean Peninsula. The Soviet Union actually did that. The Soviet troops left in 1948. But the colonial character of the U.S. intervention in Southern Korea and South Korea after World War II is unmistakable. In fact, at the surrender ceremony between the United States and Japan, where Japan surrendered unconditionally on August 15th, 1945, following the nuclear destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the United States military insisted that the Japanese colonial military force in South Korea or in Korea remain in the southern part of Korea until General MacArthur could arrive in Southern Korea with U.S. military forces so that they would take control over Southern Korea. So instead of liberating the Korean people from Japanese colonialism, the surrender agreement insisted that the Japanese colonial torturers of the Korean people actually remain in place. And then in early September, MacArthur and U.S. military arrived, And they set up what was, in essence, a military dictatorship in South Korea. They had Japanese collaborators, Korean collaborators with the Japanese colonial forces, become the new administrators and new military forces in Southern Korea. And they created, in essence, a puppet state made out of the former Japanese puppets who had become American puppets.
Right. Yeah, let me drive that point home for people. What happened, essentially, Japan was an imperial expansionist power up until the end of World War II. It conquered Korea. Northern Korea was liberated by the Soviets. The United States took over Japan and decided Japan should retain its colonies, and then that colonial system would become a colony of the United States. That's essentially the situation, right?
Yes, and in fact, you know, because you're dealing with Asia in general, I think there's obviously change that happens during the course of the 20th century, but there's also a great degree of continuity when it comes to colonial policy. So the Japanese takeover of Korea happened in the early 1900s, and as part of an agreement between the United States and Japan, the United States would become the colonial power in the Philippines and at the same time recognize Japanese imperialism's right to dominate Korea. So there was like a division of Asia by colonizing powers, and sometimes colonizing powers went to war with each other, but at other times they made agreements. So in this case, Japan recognized the United States would be the colonial dominant power in the Philippines, and likewise the U.S. would recognize Japanese control over Japan. The same process of colonial division and redivision of the world, most of the world, Asia, Africa, the Middle East, Latin America, that played itself out over and over and over again as free market capitalism centered in Europe was emerging as monopoly capitalism and then, you know, reconfiguring the world on an imperialist basis. And so we saw that same process play out in Asia generally and in Korea specifically. So here we had two regimes that existed in now divided Korea at the time after World War II. The northern part of Korea was under the leadership of the Korean Workers' Party, which was founded 70 years ago in October of this year. It was led by Kim Il-sung. They were communists. They had been guerrilla fighters against the Japanese colonialists. And in the southern half, as I said, you had the Japanese puppet forces who were Korean but collaborating with the Japanese colonialism, who became the new pro-American regime in southern Korea. And there was an instability in Korea, just as there was in Vietnam, between a northern communist-led and a southern U.S. Puppet government in southern Vietnam. That conflict had the hallmarks, the characteristic features, both of an internal domestic class war or civil war, and at the same time, because foreign powers were drawn in, it had the element of imperialist or anti-imperialist war. So there was the sort of intertangling between the domestic class struggle by workers and poor peasants, who were under the leadership of the communist and socialist forces, and the elites, the bourgeoisie, the comprador bourgeoisie, who were aligned with foreign imperialist powers.
Right, so the communist parties basically end up taking up the nationalist struggle.
Exactly, and so, you know, we all know now in America that in the case of Vietnam, at the Geneva Convention that separated, prepared for a unification of Vietnam. That convention happened in 1954 between the major world powers. There was a recognition that if there had been a unified electoral contest, that Ho Chi Minh would be recognized as the founder of Vietnamese independence, as the authentic leader, and thus all of Vietnam would be reunited under his leadership and thus under the leadership of the Communist Party. The U.S. and people in the United States kind of know that now from history because we know a lot about Vietnam. But we don't know much about Korea, which is called the Hidden War, even though it was a vast war like Vietnam. But similarly, Kim Il-sung as the leader and his party as the leadership of the anti-Japanese fight was considered to be the patriotic nationalist and, because they were communists, also communist forces that were liberating the country from foreign colonial powers. And Likewise, Kim Il-sung and his revolutionary followers had vast support in the southern part of the country too. And between 1945 and 1950, the U.S.-led South Korean military dictatorship executed tens of thousands of pro-communist and nationalist forces in southern Korea, just as Diem had done in Vietnam, in southern Vietnam. And that sparked an intense struggle between the revolutionary, progressive, and reactionary forces, and drew in North Korea, just as the struggle in southern Vietnam ultimately drew in North Vietnam. And there was an open military combat finally on June 25th, 1950. Within 3 days, the South Korean military had completely defeated the South Korean puppet military. They were almost at the very bottom of southern Korea within 3 days. People's committees were set up all over southern Korea by peasant and worker forces who were looking to the north for liberation. And that process then stopped and was halted only when the United Nations, which was at that point completely under the domination of the United States, authorized a UN military intervention in southern Korea, which was just a fig leaf for what amounted to a U.S. military intervention in southern Korea. And that began what we now know as the Korean War.
Yeah, and that UN action, by the way, was after a Security Council meeting that was held without the USSR present.
Right, because the Chinese Revolution, under the leadership of Mao Zedong and the Chinese Communist Party, had been victorious as of October 1st, 1949. That's 9 months before the start of the Korean War. And the U.S. Deprived Mao and the Chinese government of its seat in the United Nations Security Council, and said that seat still belonged to Chiang Kai-shek and this rump government that had fled to Formosa, to Taiwan. And in protest of that decision and in solidarity with China, the USSR was boycotting the Security Council at that time, demanding that China be seated. And so during the moment of their boycott, the United States could go in and pass a resolution authorizing military forces to be deployed against Northern Korea without the Soviets being present to exercise a veto, which they, of course, would have the right to do as a Security Council member. So that became the war, the UN, so-called, against North Korea. And then finally, the UN against North Korea and China, because China entered the war, too, by the end of 1950.
Yeah, for those folks who don't have a map and didn't do so well in geography in school, North Korea shares a border with China.
And part of the history, Don, even today, requires a look at geography, because North Korea not only shares a border in its northern part of North Korea with China, it also shares a border with what was then the Soviet Union. And so North Korea had China and the Soviet Union to its north, and on its southern flank, underneath the 38th parallel, there was the U.S. military forces, tens of thousands of them, nuclear armed, and a puppet force, military force that the U.S. had created. So by the late, 1950s, the beginning of the 1960s, when the Soviet Union and China, who were sister socialist countries and had a united front for the first decade of the existence of the People's Republic of China, as those two socialist giants started first an ideological struggle and then eventually a state-to-state dispute, taking place right on the border of North Korea, the North Korean Workers' Party was contending not only with hostile forces from imperialism and a military dictatorship in the south, but now both China and the Soviet Union, as they waged their own political ideological struggle, were trying to create within the Workers' Party of North Korea a pro-Soviet and also a pro-Chinese faction. And you saw at that moment a metamorphosis in the way the North Korean political arrangement was organized. And North Korea at that point started to emphasize that we will be self-reliant. We are on what they call Chushe, the ideology that was evolved by Kim Il-sung. In other words, self-reliance, not dependent obviously on imperialism, but also not dependent on the Soviet Union, not dependent on China, following a an independent North Korean path. And that became sort of the hallmark of North Korea's political identity and the way it organized itself. So as not to be kind of torn apart. I mean, it was a small country facing hostile imperialist powers and at the same time a very nasty split between the two fraternal or sisterly socialist communist parties in giant countries, Russia, Soviet Union, and China.
And so, also the conditions that they start this in, after the war, according to the U.S. military, there wasn't a two-story building left in North Korea after the U.S. carpet bombed it.
Right. So I think it's extremely important for Americans to realize this history because, you know, twice a year, U.S. military forces and South Korean military forces simulate the bombing and destruction and invasion of North Korea, and they call those war games. Well, they're not funny to North Korea. They're not. There's nothing game-like about them. And one of the reasons is when the United States did invade, did bomb North Korea, as you said, the main complaint of pilots, U.S. pilots, by 1951, this was like only 1 year into a three-year-long war, the main complaint by U.S. pilots was that there was, quote, nothing left to bomb because every building was destroyed in Northern Korea, every building. The bombing was so complete, so comprehensive, not one structure more than one story high existed in the northern part of the country. And at first, the United States felt that their overwhelming force was going to lead to a rout of North Korea, and they would reunify the Korean Peninsula under the domination of the United States and under the domination of its puppet government in the south. But in November, December 1950, to their shock and surprise, China sent a million volunteers, and the North Koreans had regrouped as guerrilla forces in the mountains in the north, and they counter-offensed against the Americans, against the UN so-called mission, and drove them back down below the 38th parallel. And that's where the war froze. And it continued, the bombing continued until July 27th, 1953. The U.S. had planned to carry out nuclear strikes against DPRK and China if they didn't both sign an armistice agreement, sort of stalemating the war. That armistice agreement was signed. The open military clashes ended. The Encyclopedia Britannica in its 1967 edition said 5 million Koreans, 5 million Koreans had died during the course of that three-year-long conflict, either because they had been bombed or shot or they died from famine or disease. You know, just unbelievable suffering. And now today you have, all these years later, the United States replicating through war games exercises that simulate another bombing, another destruction, including the use of nuclear aircraft, nuclear armed aircraft. So, you know, politics froze in North, politics, the international situation froze the politics inside North Korea up until, and I think just for the purpose of our audience to realize that this kind of mutual antagonism, high hostility, danger of another war was very, very obvious to everyone. And so obvious, in fact, that the U.S. refused to sign the landmine treaty because they said if there's ever another Korean War, which they anticipated they might need landmines, that's the reason they didn't sign the landmine treaty. It was like that until the very, very end of the Clinton administration. And that's where we jump ahead here with the story of Korea and the Korean conflict, because in the last year, the Clinton administration started to pursue a path of normalization of relations with DPRK. They realized DPRK was not going to be overthrown. The Clinton administration had pursued a policy of regime change after the Soviet Union collapsed and the DPRK economy had tanked in the early 1990s. They pursued a policy of regime change, but they realized that wasn't going to succeed. So Clinton said, like Obama is doing today with Cuba, let's try something different. And so they began the process of diplomatic talks. The South Korean government, then under the more liberal leadership of Kim Dae-jung, had what was called the Sunshine Policy. It reached out to North Korea under the leadership of Kim Jong-il. They had a historic agreement in June 2000, representing the beginning of a possible rapprochement, normalization of relations between the North and South, which would, of course, have been inconceivable without having been given a green light by Clinton, because the U.S. is the real overlord, the real power in South Korea. And then Clinton dispatched Madeleine Albright, who was then the Secretary of State, and she went and met with the North Korean leadership, and it looked like there was about to be a real thaw, a real change, possibly a peace treaty. The North Koreans suspended their nuclear arms program. There was a lot of hope and optimism at that point in North Korea, South Korea, and of course among overseas Koreans. But then, soon as George W. Bush came in, the first act he carried out was he invited Kim Dae-jung, the South Korean president, to come to the White House in March 2001. And when he arrived, he was treated rudely. His sunshine policy was ridiculed. George W. Bush ridiculed the North Korean leadership personally, called them names. And then shortly thereafter, he made his famous speech that there's an axis of evil, and it's Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. That was in January 2002, and the North Koreans could see, well, the axis of evil includes Iraq. They're about to be invaded. Iran, the Bush administration wanted to invade, and we're next too. So they completely scotched all sort of rapprochement talks and began building earnestly a nuclear weapons program, because they felt, unlike Iraq, which did not have weapons of mass destruction, that weapons of mass destruction, like a nuclear bomb, could be a deterrent to U.S. imperialist aggression under the leadership of George W. Bush.
Right. The type of defensive war that they're prepared for, which is the type that they ended up fighting with the assistance of Chinese regulars, or Chinese volunteers, excuse me, is similar to the way Cuba organized against a U.S. invasion also. And, you know, you have basically the people organized, and they're ready to fight a guerrilla war if that's what happens. And the only U.S. Tool that they have available to fight that is saturation bombing and leveling of the whole country. And, of course, the nuclear weapons are stored there, and they were several times in history credibly spoken about being used there.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. It's very, the parallel is very similar. The problem for the American movement, the American progressive and peace movement in the left, and generally in society, is that unlike the Vietnam War, where we had a mass movement of people who could see that, well, this is an imperialist war against a third world country that's not threatening the United States, and people, you know, became a major factor. And thus consciousness was raised about imperialism's role in Vietnam, and thus the demonization of Ho Chi Minh and the Vietnamese Communist Party, that diminished under that the influence of a mass movement. But in the Korean War, there was no mass movement in the United States because it coincided with the witch hunt at home. That's right. And so you saw even anti-war activists like Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, who were participated in protests against the Korean War, well, they were charged with, you know, giving nuclear secrets to the Soviet Union, and they were actually executed, right. Electrocuted.
Right here in Austin, New York, right where I am, right here in Sing Sing.
That's right. And you had thousands of communists who lost their job, and socialists and progressives, and anyone who signed a peace petition, or, you know, that was the dark days of the witch hunt. And thus the natural anti-war mass movement, which would have emerged otherwise and raised consciousness about Korea as it did later in Vietnam, that was stifled. It didn't mean that the American people liked the Korean War. When Truman left office, his approval ratings were about 26%. That was in 1953. And people hated the Korean War, but there was no movement because there was so much political repression. Thus the hidden war, thus not only not a mass mobilization, but not consciousness. And the most dangerous part of this phenomena is that today, even leftists are vulnerable to being influenced by the demonization campaign directed against North Korea, against the DPRK. And in other words, North Korea has remained politically isolated, even though it was clearly the victims of aggression. And so you have South Korean intelligence pumping out, using every week, another like horrendous story. Kim Jong-un just executed somebody by feeding them to the dogs. His ex-girlfriend was executed because his new wife didn't like her. Like all of these stories, which all right. always turn out to be not true.
Right.
But it doesn't matter that they're not true because they live as headlines for a week.
Yeah.
Unsubstantiated. And then finally, and because we follow Korea closely, we always document, well, oh yeah, that story disappeared too because it's not credible. But for the average reader who's not paying careful attention, the demonizing headlines create an image. And the image is North Korea is the hermit kingdom. It's isolated because it wants to be isolated. It carries out mass atrocities. Life is awful there. And so people don't know. Well, you know, in North Korea, there's 100% literacy. The age expectancy is in the mid-70s. The country is clean. It has a great subway system in Pyongyang. In spite of all of the sanctions and attacks and the requirement to divert resources to its military, people in North Korea have full employment. Education is free. Healthcare is free. I mean, whatever you think about this, that, or the other thing in terms of North Korea's political establishment and its orientation, the social achievements of the regime are considerable. And before the United States decided earnestly to build up South Korea as an economic superpower in the early 1970s, North Korea was actually ahead of South Korea economically. What we're doing right now and what we in the Answer Coalition are trying to do is help break down sort of the colorful, demonizing, and unsubstantiated stereotyping of North Korea, which is only designed to create hatred towards them and allow people to have a way to sort of understand North Korea, learn about it, mobilize around it. And fundamentally, we are demanding that the United States end the Korean War once and for all, sign a peace treaty, end sanctions, allow there to be normal relations. I mean, the United States ended the war with Japan, fascist Germany and Japan in 1945. Those countries became, allies. The United States didn't punish them after the war. It rehabilitated them. In other words, the policies of the United States are not really the consequence of how bad North Korea is. They're really the consequence of how imperialism hasn't given up on its efforts to overthrow the government in North Korea, not because they care about democracy, not because they care about human rights, not because they care about liberation, but because they want to reunify North Korea under a puppet government on China's borders, which of course would, you know, if anything, accentuate the possibility of a new regional and even global conflict.
And next week, I think we'll pick up with that the work that Answer Coalition is doing to try to open Americans up to what's happening in Korea. And thank you for your time this week.
Great. Thanks for having us.
As we go out, we'll listen to a little bit of music from the DPRK called Defend the Headquarters of the Revolution. That's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.